Welcome to the podcast edition of Dream Talk Radio. I'm your host, Anne Hill, and every week I explore topics related to dreams, sleep, health, culture, and consciousness. Dream Talk Radio airs every Thursday from 9 to 10 a.m. Pacific Time on KOWS 107.3 FM in Occidental, California. And you can catch the live stream at www.kows.fm. Meanwhile, I hope you enjoy this edition of Dream Talk Radio. I have a very special show for you today. Last week, I traveled to Silicon Valley to speak with Bill Fenwick, who is a founding partner of the prominent law firm Fenwick & West. Bill Fenwick has been involved with issues of global technology since the early 1970s and as part of an organization called Program for the Future, which finds better ways for people to work together, make decisions together, and solve problems. So with me on the trip last week was Eileen Clegg of Visual Insight and Program for the Future, who I've interviewed on this show before. As Bill Fenwick was describing to me the needs for e-government initiatives to make government more efficient and effective, Eileen was drawing a mural that rendered the entire conversation in graphic form. So the result was amazing, and we actually have video of her mural creation, which will be up on the web soon with links to this podcast. But meanwhile, here is my interview with Bill Fenwick, who is talking about some of the big problems facing governments and society today. It's my pleasure to talk with you because I know that you have been putting a lot of effort into initiatives to help help facilitate what you call collective intelligence. And maybe you can give us a little snapshot of where the term comes from, what the philosophy of collective intelligence is.
Many years ago, a man named Doug Engelbart was probably the first person that I'm aware of that was concentrating on the issue of collective intelligence. His theory and thesis was very simple. If you combine the intelligence of more than one person, you will have something that will turn out better than it would if there were only one. Now you can explode from that and go into the current terminology is crowdsourcing. Mm-hmm. Doug, not only did he come up with this theory for collective intelligence, he also set for himself the task of developing the tools that are necessary to improve the collection of collective intelligence. And that was first demonstrated in 1968 in something that is called the Great Demonstration. It's available on numerous websites. All you have to do is look for the Great Demonstration and you'll turn it up. It's there on video. What has occurred that is relevant to e-government is that the other social impact that is occurring as a result of the increased efficiency of collective intelligence has been to speed up significantly transactions in society. And by transactions, what we mean is any interchange between two people, people in institutions, two institutions, etc. How does government get into this? Well, government gets into this because the job of government, really, from the beginning, I mean, you can trace this back to the U.S. Constitution. What the government was trying to do was to develop policies that would facilitate an environment that would benefit the citizens. In order to do that, you have to collect a lot of information. When you have only two people, well, it's not a lot of information.
That's right. You can use a little notepad.
That's right. But when it gets to three, you got to get a bigger notepad. What that really means is that the government's burden, just as the value of networking is often talked about as a geometric progression.
Yeah.
Every time you add one node to a network, the value added is a geometrical progression, not an arithmetical.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it's arithmetical as to the node, but the impact in terms of its ability to create transactions is geometric.
So at the time that Doug Engelbart was doing the great demonstration, this is what, 1968?
Correct.
At the same, the government was financing, was it DARPANET, the early types of communications, digital communications?
Yes, DARPA was set up principally to finance activities that were projected to be
right.
futuristic.
Right.
And they were concerned most about having an ability to communicate
right.
among the various parts of the government and the military that could not be disabled by a single strike.
Right.
That led to the creation of what you were referring to as DARPANET.
Yeah.
The DARPANET was initially activity involving government agencies and mm-hmm. personnel and scientists in universities,
mm-hmm.
Centered an awful lot around the University of Illinois. But DARPANET became such a surprising innovation
mm-hmm.
that at some point someone said, we need to think about taking this, making it available to society mm-hmm. as a whole. And that was when they began to let other people use DARPANET.
Right.
It subsequently sort of reappeared as internet.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point in time, there were no particularly good browser.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the big holdup because the DARPANET and the internet was totally dependent on DOS instructions
yes.
being entered from a keyboard.
Right.
When they developed the first browser, which was, I think, developed at the University of Illinois, that started the whole exercise of the scientific community in creating an improved browser. The most improved browser that came along that really helped launch the whole thing was Netscape.
Right.
Then after Netscape, of course, you developed other browsers. Microsoft developed a browser, and there are now probably 15 different
right.
browsers that you can use, all of them having their particular points of prejudice. But the important thing was you now had an ability for someone who did not have advanced degrees
mm-hmm.
in technology
mm-hmm.
to be able to use this system.
Right.
It became something that was the best browsers were those mm-hmm. that were the most intuitive. That gets you to a situation in which you now have taken this thing that was sort of hidden away with the government
yes.
And the universities, and you've loosed it on society.
Right.
That meant that the number of transactions
mm-hmm.
that could be facilitated in society
mm-hmm.
was greatly increased. That also means that the speed of those transactions were greatly increased.
Right, which from the social, in the social fabric, that was excellent. We could get the sports scores right away. We could find, you know, as different businesses got their web presence and so on and so forth, there was this whole commerce that built up. And meanwhile, what you began by saying was that government needs information to function. It needs information on the infrastructure, you know, health, finances, the tax rolls, whatever. And so that was that was the function, or that was one of the maybe the guiding principles behind getting this whole internet together. And then we end up with something that's a little bit, there's a ton of information coming through.
That's right. The government here, the initial motive of the government was to, in effect, produce a very robust communication system that could be used for coordination of government activities in times of national emergencies, wars, and that sort of thing. When they made it available to society, it obviously, just as facilitating communications between the government, individuals, and agencies, it began to do the same thing with regard to people and entities that were a part of what we will call the civil society. That speed up in transactions, because remember, we started out by saying it's the government's job to provide an environment that facilitates the activities of the civil sector. Well, you know, if what you've got is 10 people, 2 horses, and a wagon, and that's the whole population of the territory you're governing, you don't have to have a lot of information to do that.
Very short meetings.
That's right. And, you know, also very short legislative. Because the Constitution set up a construction that said, we want the policy made by the legislature. We want the executive run by the president with the responsibility to implement the policy. We want the judiciary to be available to resolve disputes that arise out of this implementation or these increased transactions between people. That was your three branches of government. Now we've got a situation in which we have over 300 million people. And if you listen to the pundits, that 300 million people have somewhere in the neighborhood of 5.5 to 6 million vehicles. They have a huge number of households. There's a huge amount of business. Okay, well, now then, the job of government has been made significantly more complex. This grew gradually in the beginning, but once, every time it grew, the next transaction would come faster than the last transaction. So that created capacity.
And by transactions, you're talking about any exchange of information between departments, between bureaus, between the executive and legislative branch. I mean, that's a broadly defined term, is that right?
Transaction covers not only the communication, it covers the transfer of goods between entities. It basically is any time you have two supposedly independent entities, whether they be people or organizations, that interact, each interaction is a transaction. You speed those up. Now the government is dealing with a situation in which it is having billions and billions, in fact, hundreds of billions of transactions that are occurring every day. I mean, the stock market alone is an example of how that can grow. What this meant to the government is that now all of a sudden its policies had to accommodate a society that was experiencing this explosion of transactions. There was an economist at the University of Chicago in the 20s and the 30s. His name was Coors. He looked at transactions as an economist, and he either invented or certainly enhanced the idea of transaction costs. His theory was pretty simple, whether you're applying it to the social environment or you're applying it to the business environment. The principle that he established was that if the transaction costs becomes high enough that it exceeds the value of the transaction, the transaction will not take place. With regard to government, if the government is attempting to regulate or be informed about these transactions that are taking place in order to make the policies, it adds to the transaction cost. This, I guess you could say, this is sort of the initial seed for the argument against big government, because they say big government just creates enormous cost, interferes with life, interferes with your activity. Well, the bottom line is, it's hard to create an environment that is favorable to positive transactions without getting more involved.
But, sorry, go ahead.
So what happens is the government had to expand its information gathering. It did that. The Depression led to a significant increase in the number of reporting units and receiving units. As the transactions in society speeded up, they buried those government administrative agencies. The administrative agencies could not process the information they were gathering fast enough to prevent. Because when the government is, what people really expect of the government, they expect them to facilitate the transaction. If the transaction goes wrong, they expect the government to figure out why it went wrong, and then they expect the government to create a policy that will remedy that without, with the minimum amount of impinging on the freedom of individuals. But that is that creates an enormous amount of information. Now, the government is probably a good 25 or 30 years behind the private sector in its ability to use electronic information. That's what e-government is really about. It's about creating the ability of the government to use electronic information for the purpose of gathering, creating the policies, implementing those in laws, and improving the quality of the social environment and the business environment.
So you have a situation in which over the past few decades, massive explosion in population, number one. So there's more people to collect more data or to keep track of households and cars and whatnot. Also, the means of communicating that information, each of those transactions, is speeded up by virtue of more phone lines and then cell phone lines and then, you know, DARPANET turning into the internet and so on and so forth. But meanwhile, the systems that government has to process that those transactions are somewhat stuck behind. They haven't kept pace with technology, so that the transaction, the cost of each of those transactions in terms of speed, efficiency, and also just plain old money, economics, is way larger. And it's so it's a backlog. We're talking about a backlog of all kinds of information.
It is. And the, the idea of e-government is that the government will begin to use those analytical capabilities of the computer that private industry has been using for a long, long time. And another illustration of that, I don't want to dwell too much on that point, but the government has had computers. I mean, the government owned the first computer. But what happened is, I'm sure you've heard the story about how someone was talking about the business plan of IBM wasn't really a good one because there would only need to be 12 computers in the country to be able to do all the processing that needed to be done. Well, of course, that turned out not to be true. And then there along came many computers that exploded the numbers even more, principally by driving down the cost, increasing the power. Then you have Moore's Law coming along, which is basically saying that the capacity will double and the cost will be halved every 18 months. So you can begin to see what kind of dynamics that the government is dealing in. The government used the computers that it had, but they were not computers that easily communicated with mm-hmm. one another, or in some cases communicated at all. So one agency would get information that is relevant to five agencies. Mm-hmm. It processes it and it generates a report, which it then sends to the five agencies. Mm-hmm. The five agencies have their systems, and so they turn around in the beginning and they rekey all of that information into their systems, which generates reports that go out to all the other agencies. And the first thing you know, you've got 10, 12, maybe hundreds of re-entries that are taking place. Well, re-entry is a very dangerous process because it is the source of most of the errors that occur in electronic information. Didn't take very long until everyone began to realize that you're much better off to capture the information at the source and distribute it in a way that everybody that needs to see it can receive it electronically, and it goes directly into their system, and they do the analytics, and they generate information out. And that information is compatible with all the other computers that they're sending it to in cities, states, counties, and countries.
Right.
This is not just the United States. Right. It's the whole world. That means that if we don't improve significantly the capability of the government to utilize electronic information, they are never going to be able to keep up. Mm-hmm. You're going to have a lot of financial crises and crashes. You're going to have huge problems with almost every aspect of society, from the Food and Drug Administration letting foods and drugs into the marketplace. It now takes such a long time and so expensive that there are many actual almost miracle type drugs that don't make it to the market for 8 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. And of course, if those happen to be drugs that we're dealing with life-threatening diseases, you've killed off a bunch of people. So all of this ties together. The e-government initiative that is being worked on now by the Program for the Future. Incidentally, Program for the Future has really been created to carry out many of the ideas that Doug Engelbart came up with.
Right.
Most people will know Doug Engelbart, if they know him at all, they'll know him as the person who invented the mouse. But Doug's accomplishment, that's not a small accomplishment, but his accomplishments are a lot greater than that.
Yes.
So now we find ourselves in a situation in which the government is getting huge amounts of information.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I, along with some assistance from other people, have decided to call this TMI, too much information.
Yes.
There is a counterforce to too much information that further boosts. It's almost like a second set of booster rockers, rockets, and it's called TLT.
Except those booster rockets are directed right towards the mountain of too much information.
That's right, but it's TLT is too little time.
Yeah.
And so the TLT is causing the mountain to grow every day. And that mountain, it consists of all of the organizations and institutions that are creating information that the government needs in order to do its job.
Right.
And that society needs in order to continue to raise the standard of living. It's kind of interesting and not a little bit off topic. Mm-hmm. But there's never been a society that has been able to significantly increase the standard of living that didn't use slaves.
Right.
We have slaves now. They are the what many people will call undocumented immigrants is the most current excitement that goes on, but they are, in effect, that group of people is working at a wage that is far less than the value that they're creating. The value that they're creating then is used by the rest of society to raise the standard of living, mostly of the rest of society.
Right. Not just here, but many countries.
All over the world.
Yeah.
All over the world.
Yeah.
What we ought to be trying to do is that we ought to be trying to convert the slave part of this to machines, but that's another topic for another day. The end result of what's happening is that the burden of the government is getting larger and larger and larger, and the government's capacity for dealing with it is getting less and less every day.
So here we have a situation. You mentioned earlier how private enterprise was about 30 years ahead of government in terms of its ability to process information,
Correct. Make
quick decisions, and just, you know, sort of process it all and then come up with a strategy and implementation. That's what the interesting thing to me about this e-government, because here are all of these entrepreneurial types, people who see that, okay, we have the systems, we actually have the technology, or maybe we can think of it together with this sort of idea of collective intelligence. If we can all put our skill sets together, we can figure out ways to help get that sort of the backlog of information flowing better. We can help adjust the systems. I'm paraphrasing.
It is. The what's most of the activity. There is a lot of entrepreneurship that's being devoted to assisting the government in many different ways, but most of the really incredible advances that are taking place in innovation are directed at the private sector.
Right.
Now, we started out, when we first started the initiative, we started out by saying, okay, now our objective is to try to diffuse that resistance to the government using electronic information that is not really productive. So rather than concentrating on issues like privacy, which is a concern that's near and dear to everyone's heart, we said, okay, well, what is it? What is the benefit that's going to come to society as a result of this? And the answer is, the response time of the government is now way below what's necessary to maintain a civil society. The cost of government is way above what people will pay. That's why you have this enormous movement about taxes, because the way the government gets its revenue is that it taxes the transactions between people, hopefully that are profitable, and it gets its revenue. With that revenue, it then provides the necessary facilitation in society to assist in creating an environment that continues to increase the standard of living of the people. But we said, okay, well, what we want to do is that we want to get a dialogue going about e-government, so we can get greater emphasis and attention to it. The first thing we ran into was the concerns of privacy. But the second thing that we found out, as regards the initiative that the Program for the Future is working on, is that there's a whole bunch of organizations out there that are trying to work on different aspects of e-government. So our initiative now has, in effect, transmogrified into an effort to get those groups collaborating, doing that by producing tools that will improve their ability to collaborate, so that you can get a lot more efficiency in the efforts that are being expended to create a better environment and better tools for the government to use in trying to deal with TMI and TLT.
So what are some of the specific venues or the specific crossroads of different people, different initiatives working on different things that you see e-government being in a position to really help facilitate? Where are the places?
Everything.
That, everything.
Everything. I mean, you know, just look at the progress in stoplights. When I was a good deal younger than I am now, you drove up to a stoplight. That stoplight was set up with a mechanical device that changed the light ever so many seconds or minutes.
Right.
And it didn't matter if there were 15 buses coming or nothing. It still took the same amount of time. Look at what you get now. You get stoplights that can figure out that between 8 a.m. and 9:30, that the traffic in the left lane, that is the lane that's turning left, is very, very heavy. And so they will heuristically start lengthening or shortening the time to match it toward match it to the load. That's just a simple example that everybody, I think, if they think about it, will will realize.
Well, if they're in a large enough area to have relatively new stoplights, there is that.
There is. There are other areas. That's like everything else. You have to have the critical mass need.
That's right.
Before you get solutions.
Yes.
But we think that the best way to getting a solution to making the government more responsive, more economic, and more transparent is to increase the use of e-government. Because one of the things that e-government does is that it makes transparency immediately available.
Yeah.
Tim O'Reilly is doing quite a lot of work on in the area of transparency and privacy. For that reason, we decided that that while that is a very valuable, we would have a better use of our time, not replicating what Tim is doing, but rather focusing on trying to get people to properly evaluate the benefits that can come from this.
Yes.
And in a couple of articles that I've published, I have talked about it as not voluntary, that e-government is a necessity if we're going to continue to be a civilized society, resolving our differences in an efficient manner without hitting each other on the head or shooting each other or bombing each other with nuclear weapons.
Right. Well, now you've spent your career in law, and I can just imagine that you've seen up close many myriad ways that the judicial system could benefit from application of e-government principles.
Yes, and about nearly 20 years ago, the judiciary of the state of California had a chief judge that asked for the courts to develop a picture of the courts in 2020.
Oh.
One aspect of that was technology.
Yeah.
I, along with some people from Stanford, were asked to author a basic white paper, which we did. It wasn't what the committee was looking for, but it basically recommended that they create a technology advisory committee for the judicial council. And I worked on that for 12 years, up until, I guess, about 3 or 4 years ago, attempting to move the courts. The courts are probably the least automated branch of state, local, and federal government. We worked on the state courts. We started working on e-filing, and now we have a situation in which, as a result of that effort, there has been a pilot, a significant pilot, that has been operating for a few years now that is concerned with the court management system. And the court management system starts out with the same kind of problem.
Yeah.
They've got to know how many disputes they've got, mm-hmm. how many judges they've got, what are the issues in the in these disputes, and they got to be able to transfer a tremendous amount of paper.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example that, that was used often when we were advocating the electronic filing. Yeah. The storage, the courts of this country, up until probably the mid-80s, were repositories. That is, they had the pleadings and the evidence that was presented in whatever disputes were brought before them. This produced a situation in which, because for every matter, they had a file number or a case number, and all of the pleadings and the other stuff related to that went into that file. Mm-hmm. By law, that file is public. So anybody can could go into a courthouse where a case was pending and say, I want to see the file for such and such a case.
Mm-hmm.
And they would get a chance to see it. They would be given a chance to copy documents out of it, etc.
Mm-hmm.
To give you an example of how bad the situation was, because the number of requests were huge.
Yeah.
The clerical staff of the court could not keep up with the demand.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, anytime you take a document as a court person, you take a document out of a file to present it to a member of the public mm-hmm. who has requested to see it, when that person is finished with it, you got to go put it back in that file.
Uh-huh.
They
so
have over
two trips per
and
request.
More important, they have a few billion files.
So misfiling became rampant.
And the minute it got misfiled, it was gone.
Just disappeared.
You could never, it would only be by accident that you could ever find it. Now, you could conduct, obviously, an audit of all those files if you could hire four generations to assist you with it. And
goodness.
In that process, I mean, you know, it's kind of a joke to even think about doing it that way, but that's one of the problems.
Right.
And that's a problem that they're trying to get at. Hopefully that will survive. There is some opposition that has grown up to that.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
And what's the pushback against that idea?
Information is the greatest source of power mm-hmm. in our society.
Yep.
Turf. The state of California up until, even at this time, the state of California has 58 different court systems. A court system for each county.
Uh-huh.
They are not, there's no hierarchy in terms of the administration of the court.
Mm-hmm.
Every county does with its courts what it wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
The current Chief Justice, who is retiring, I think may have already been retired, started with a situation in which, other than asking, there wasn't much you could do. There was passed something called the trial court funding,
mm-hmm.
where the counties had exhausted the resources mm-hmm. that they could allocate to courts.
Mm-hmm.
The trial court funding bill shifted the obligation to fund those courts away from the counties to the state.
Mm-hmm. And this was in the 80s, 90s?
It actually came to fruition in the early to mid 90s. Uh-huh. I think that's when the act took effect. Well, you know, that meant now the Judicial Council, who was the organization that was allocating these funds, had a little bit more influence than they had before.
Right.
And so that's how they've been able to make the progress that they've made. But when you do that, when every court is an independent entity unto itself, information about what that court's doing or not doing is a source of a tremendous amount of power.
Right. So it's, in some ways, they would perceive it as not being in their interest to have all of their all the files electronically accessible.
That's right. Because, you know, if you get the files electronically accessible, accessible, you all of a sudden, there are a lot of analytics that can be applied to look at the productivity of a particular county, a particular court, a particular judge, and understand that all of these have court staff.
Right.
And so this power that you're talking about, it's not unusual to the court. Mm-hmm. It operates in everyday society.
Right.
You know, you can look at your influence like a bank account. Mm-hmm. The more people that you help, the greater your deposits.
Right.
The greater your deposits, the more people you can help, the more power you possess. Mm-hmm. And that phenomena goes on throughout our society. Yeah.
This touches on a point that Eileen and I were talking about driving down here, which is that the idea of collective intelligence, we can simply pool the resources we have, organize them better, make them more accessible with more transparency, and decrease the cost of everything, save an incredible amount of money, and be able to do more of the stuff that we can't afford to do right now. And so, I mean, it's a brilliant vision, and the pushback against this is often what I refer to as collective unintelligence. You know, it's the turf wars. It's like, well, I actually have this fiefdom here. This is working pretty well for me. I don't see the need to change. I'm resistant to change. Or maybe I think that there's this sort of, we have the whole idea of Big Brother came along right at the same time as all these internet, everything was going pretty quickly. So it's a trick. I think there's, when you're talking about e-government, I see this, you know, as a real, you have to sort of walk a fine line and not only emphasize all the benefits to everyday, I mean, if I go to the DMV, right, you know, all these different ways that my experience will be enhanced by having stuff online rather than having to walk in and talk to somebody and get forms and take them back. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So you have to play up the benefits, but also counter this idea that somehow disturbing the status quo is not going to work or is going to cause more problems than it solves.
Well, if I can be a little bit prejudiced here, the problem is that when you're looking at something like, for instance, the people who, the DMV in the state, the people that are in the DMV realize that if you make it more efficient, surprise, surprise, you'll get more work. We have not done well at allocating the benefits that come from being able to make processes more efficient. Mm-hmm. The people who are opposed to this, and some of them, I don't want to attribute negative motives to them, because their motives are present in every human being.
Sure.
But what they have done is that they have tried to turn this thing around and market their opposition as being a protection of the freedom of the people and the institutions, because they say if you have government intruding, you don't have the freedom. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, I've never heard anybody explain how the government can provide this facilitation to the public without getting involved. And if they get involved, then somebody starts yelling, intrusion on our freedom. And I think all of this really stems, if there is a single powerful motive, all of it stems from the desire to avoid change. There is, a lot of people will talk about vested interest and all that. Well, that's true. You know, if you have a job where you are paid enormous amounts of money, and somebody comes along and says, hey, you know, you can do that job a lot more efficiently if you use this repository or that form of electronic information, that means that your job is going to change. It probably means your compensation is going to change. And there is born the vested interest. Plus, having the political power. Now we've turned it into a really pernicious situation, I think. We have, ever since anybody felt privileged enough to comment on the government of other countries, we have concentrated on the corruption of the government of other countries. It would be, in my view, very difficult to find any country where you can have interest groups through money, by influence, that protects their vested interest. But that's the society we've got right now. The bottom line is, money is a very powerful ingredient in this whole process. Again, not that everybody is bad. That's not true. The vast majority of people are not bad people, and it doesn't mean that just because you don't want to change, you're bad. It simply means that this is the reality of what you have when you have a society that grows more complex and with a lot of population growth every day.
Well, I mean, this brings me, and this one of my things that I get passionate about is the need for education, but not just education in the broad sense to inform people of what's happening, but we need to be really smart about the stories we tell. You know, if we tell somebody a story of, hey, we can rearrange your whole database, we can turn it into this, and then boom, you'll have, you know, we need to anticipate the reaction, which is, oh no, I'll have more work on my desk. Right now I can leave at 4:30 in the afternoon, and now I'll have to stay till 6 every day to keep up with the onslaught. So it's a problem of storytelling, I think, because, as you say, I mean, the people who have a vested interest in keeping things the same, that's an easy story to sell to people. You know, it's impinging on our freedoms. Our hallowed traditional way of life is in jeopardy. So the e-government and anybody who's trying to strive to get some innovation in there and improve the systems has to have a very smart, easily, readily understandable story.
Well, the greatest, if you are permitted to back out the emotion, the greatest source of terror in a civilized society is change. We are not built to deal with change that affects us. We are wonderfully capable of dealing with change that affects everybody else. But not us.
No, it's true. That's,
and so that's what we're struggling with. I think that we could greatly decrease the intrusion of government if we can make it more efficient, if we can make it more responsive. And everyone yells, yeah, but you know, you're giving all this information to the government will become more powerful. Well, if you are doing things electronically, you are creating records that can be looked at on the web, and misconduct can easily be recognized and dealt with. So, and you know, that ties in some other very basic human tendencies. I don't want you to know everything about me, at least not until I get to know everything about you and make the decision that, yes, I think I would not mind sharing information about me with this person. But it takes a tremendous amount of effort to build a relationship that has that kind of trust. And that's way off the subject of what we were talking about, but it's some of the same thing. We've got to recognize that we either slow down all this activity and we stop having this progress that everyone wants to talk about in innovation and job creation and suffer the consequences, i.e. recessions, depression, and unemployment. Or we're going to have to figure out an efficient way to provide the activity and the opportunity. I think that e-government, while it is not going to be creating big companies, and hopefully won't be creating lots and lots of jobs, because that's the problem with its cost right now. And most of the people that work in government made a contract a long time ago when they got involved in government, and that is, they said, I have this urge to serve the public. And yeah, I know the public sector doesn't pay as well as the private sector, but hey, I can get along with that. I can get along with what I'm being paid. And so they made that contract. Now, when we're, and I say now, like September 24th, 2010, the private sector job looks like a pretty good deal. Although there is going to be some incredible number, I've read that the state governments in the upcoming year will lay off 500,000 people because they don't have the funds to retain them. So, but you can't blame the public servants for saying, wait a minute, we made this deal, and now you're going to take the deal away from me. And I've been here in many cases. These people have, I don't know what the average length of a government employee tenure is, but I suspect that it's somewhere in the 10-year range, and that means you've got some people that have worked for the government for 50 years, and some that worked 5 minutes, but that's a deal that was cut a long time ago. Are we going to have to modify it? Yes. Is it going to be easy to do? No, because, boy, you talk about goring somebody's interest. You're goring a whole bunch of people's interest there. But I again think that the secret to getting more productivity with less strain and faster response is to get the government to move into this society that has been built of electronic communications.
Well, clearly the problems are legion. I'm optimistic because the program for the future, the way that there's this group of people, not just one person, it's not just led by one person, but it's this group of people interfacing with the OpenGov folks and Gov 2.0 and trying to figure out ways to facilitate this. It just seems like a smart place to put energy and effort.
It is smart, and it's smart in two different ways. One is that it gives one the opportunity to serve the rest of mankind, which is always a good feeling. But it's smart in another sense, and that is, if you don't do it, the process will be destroyed.
That's right. Yeah.
So it won't exist for anybody.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the problem that we're struggling with. I'm sure that many things that I've said today will upset some people who don't want to have to think about, well, I shouldn't say that. They are very concerned about changing their value system to accommodate the present problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you change your value system, you destabilize your entire existence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty tough thing. The brain's not very good at dealing with it.
Yeah, that is true. Well, we are in a time of change, so in for a penny, in for a pound, I suppose.
Well, yeah, but it's a lot easier for some people to accept it than
true.
It is for others.
That's true. It's causing real hardship.
And everybody sort of thinks that education is the elixir. But I don't think that's true. I think the elixir is to get people to think about why they are opposed to change.
Mm-hmm.
And what are going to be the benefits,
mm-hmm.
what are going to be the detriments.
Mm-hmm.
If they do that analysis and it turns out that the detriments are greater than the benefits, well, that'll be the way it'll go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it needs an honest evaluation, and it can't be done without suspicion.
Yeah.
If it's the people that are involved in the process, it's got to come from the public.
Well, Bill Fenwick, thank you so much for your efforts on all of our behalfs and spurring on this e-government initiative. And thank you so much for taking time out to talk with us on Dream Talk Radio and wherever on the web this interview ends up landing.
Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure.
That was my interview with Bill Fenwick last week. Bill Fenwick of Fenwick & West in Silicon Valley. You can find out more about Program for the Future at programforthefuture.org and also on their Facebook page by the same name. I will continue to highlight innovations in technology and government, especially open government, here on Dream Talk Radio as I explore more the frontiers of culture, consciousness, and dreams of the future. That ends this week's Dream Talk Radio Show podcast. Thanks for listening, and remember to tune in every Thursday from 9 to 10 a.m. at www.kows.fm. This is Ann Hill, and I'll see you again next week.